Good morning. Be seated, please. The first case on our calendar is 98-2542, State of Ohio versus Frederick Treisch. Mr. Lobey. State of Ohio did not file a brief and so on time, so they did not have oral arguments.
I understand. I'm just reserving time to be able to ask questions.
Okay.
Which I believe the court did allow. Okay. I think I asked questions around 5 minutes. Initially, I restate my motion for reversal based upon Supreme Court Rule 6, Section 6,
they couldn't argue,
which I filed. This case is a death penalty case and emanates as a result of a split decision from the 11th District Court of Appeals, 120 pages of a majority opinion with a strong dissent, and applies to various propositions of law. My main and primary focus today, as in the Court of Appeals, as in the dissent from Justice Judge O'Neill from the 11th District, applies to proposition of law 2, whether or not the trial court failed to suppress statements made without the proper Mirandizing in violation of the 5th, 6th, and 14th Amendments of the United States Constitution, as well as Article 1, Section 10 of the Ohio Constitution. Focus on my entire brief will not only be on this particular issue, but also on Proposition 4, 5, and 15, which are the grand jury transcripts, failure to provide daily transcripts, and ineffective assistance of counsel, which I'll argue cumulatively, and if time permitting, I'll also argue the destruction of evidence in Proposition Law 3. And finally, if I have enough time, I'll argue on Proposition 17, the victim impact impropriety that I've alleged in the brief.
I'd like to be sure that you save time for the last point, so you may want to be sure you don't run out of time. The victim statements.
I agree with that. You could start with that, as far as I'm concerned.
That's an important issue, at least two of us, I think.
I'll mix it up then. My prayer in this particular regard is as follows, that there be a total reversal based upon all the propositions of law enunciated in my brief. Number two, a remand back to the trial court for a new trial. Number three, remand back to the Court of Appeals for a proper appellate review, consistent with the decision made by the U.S. Supreme Court in the Dickerson case, which was enunciated last week, which goes to the issue of the Mirandizing issues. I think the majority of that case, and I'm going to argue this in greater detail, goes primarily to the Court of Appeals used a lot of standards and tests, which I think the court at that time had the right to imply that there was an erosion of Miranda and use those tests to come to its majority opinion. And I think that by and through a 7-2 decision now, and a surprising decision, at least from my vantage point, that Miranda was not reversed, but in fact incorporated into a greater and higher level. And some of the language incorporated in there, I think, makes the whole Court of Appeals decision and its analysis that maybe this case now is not right for your appellate review from Court of Appeals.
I don't know why anybody thought they would.
And last, I would ask that this court affirm the decision as to the charge without the death penalty specifications. Let me first talk then about proposition of law. Number two, the issue of suppression and the Miranda. A few relevant facts are necessary to highlight. I'm confident this court has reviewed the briefs, Court of Appeals, but facts are vital in this particular case. August 28, 1994, the defendant is arrested at around 12:15. He is arrested by a Euclid police officer, Janison. There is no written Miranda warnings, and there is a difference between Janicek and the appellant as to whether Miranda warnings were given. But affirmatively, there was never a written Miranda signed or waiver of anything of that nature. Additionally, there is nothing in his reports until 2 months later that the Miranda warnings were given. Number three is the defendant was still on drugs. Even the Court of Appeals decision indicates that he, quote, looked dirty. In his taped statement, the appellant indicated that he had at least 1 gram of cocaine still in him. The next time frame is approximately 2 hours plus later. We are now on August 28, 1994. It is now 2:22 a.m. The client has been transferred from the Cleveland to the Euclid to the Eastland. These are all municipal cities on the border of Lake Erie going in an easterly direction, about 15 to 20 miles from Cleveland, 10 miles to Euclid, another 5 to 10 to Eastland. He is interrogated by a lieutenant, a now lieutenant, then detective or sergeant, who teaches constitutional law and is not given any Miranda warnings in that particular case until approximately 1 hour and 1 minute into a custodial interrogation. And after 1 hour and 1 minute, from 2:22 a.m. to 3:23 a.m., there is a failed, totally inadequate, and a totally unconstitutional attempt to try and Mirandize him, and even misinformation is given at that point.
You're discounting, counsel, the testimony by the arresting officer that he did offer the Miranda warnings upon arrest.
I'm not discounting it. I acknowledge that it is a provision made, but once we get into the new decisions from Dickerson, I think it takes away all the analysis made by the Court of Appeals on this totality and the ability to waiver it and the express ability to waiver it. And I think that takes into consideration those factors.
Well, even under Dickerson, I'm wondering if your argument taking Dickerson's, the Dickerson opinion into account, under your argument, do you concede the finding that the arresting officer properly administered the Miranda warnings?
It's disputed. I'd also have to point out the fact that I started with, that the pragmatic and the reality issues, and I'll be talking about a lot of pragmatic and reality issues, is that it would have or should have been in his initial report, and it was not in his initial report.
The trial court found it, though, as a matter of fact.
Oh, I understand what the trial court found.
Okay, so you would need us to find that fact, to find that that's not so, somehow change the facts which were presented with, in order to follow your reasoning and the Dickerson opinion, would we need to first find differently than the trial court found with regard to that particular fact?
Not necessarily. I think you can, but it's not necessarily, it's not determinative upon your opinion. Continuing on this timeline, we have an experienced police officer, teacher of constitutional law, no written Miranda warrant. And ironically, to aid and to give the second part, the first attempt to give Miranda warnings is almost the reason why I can say that Miranda warnings were not given. Why ask for express written waiver of Miranda warnings at 7:50 in the morning by the FBI and at 10:40 approximately, the same day by the same officer? Why would you go back? In fact, I use it as, I think they tried to cure what they didn't do the first time. But the problem is, once the horses are out of the gate, once the statement is given, once you have an hour and 45 minutes of a confession, and I'm not speaking yet about the request for counsel, which is a totally separate issue, you don't go back then and say, and you could just envision this,
Well, you could envision that. I didn't envision it that way. I envisioned that what he did is gave him the Miranda warnings again because he was going to continue the interrogation.
Why weren't they then given in the same fashion, at the same time, by the same police department, by the same experienced officer?
Well, the defendant, the accused, rather, said a couple times, I know what they are, kind of like, you know, don't tell me, don't bother me with reading those to me again. Do we put any weight on that? Does that mean anything?
Yes, Justice Martin. The problem is that the erosion of Miranda that has been coming down not only from the U.S. Supreme Court and respectfully from this court, which has been analyzing and using those cases, comes down now in Dickerson, and it not only takes the old Miranda warnings and elevates it to a constitutional right. It says that it is a concrete principle, and I'm going to quote from it. So you can't just now shift the burden. Well, he knew what he was doing. He's an experienced defendant. You can't take that assumption and proposition. That's the way the case law was intended. You have to look at the totality of the circumstances. And one of the issues on the totality was his experience. But this new Dickerson case, and I will say I haven't had time to totally digest it.
But should we even be applying this new Dickerson case to this case?
Absolutely. In fact, the Dickerson case analyzes most of the cases used by the Court of Appeals in setting forth the standards and the tests. It says those are not, it doesn't come directly, it says that they're overruled, okay, or reversed. But it states that the erosion of the Mirandizing issues, and most for it specifically, that it's a constitutional right must be given. And in here it even says that it is, in the exact words I have here, it indicates that the court declined to overrule Miranda, and then it said further, Miranda has become entrenched in routine police practices to the point that the warnings have become a part of our culture. It further stated in here, and I dissected it, that the totality of the circumstances test is a more difficult test than even the Miranda test. And that's why I wanted to digress, not to overrule it, but back to that the warnings must be given. It comes almost to the conclusion from my interpretation that the courts were struggling with this totality issue, and it says, no, we're not going to allow this case-by-case issue to proceed because it gets too confusing, and nor should we allow an erosion, either by case law or by legislation, which is the main gist of that particular case.
All right, let's take it through the steps, because you've lost me with some of it, even given the Dickerson case. I assume all I think Dickerson did was say Miranda rights to be given are important, they're constitutional, we've always known that, and that they have to continue to be given. So I don't see any really new tests for us to follow, and I need to get your advice here on how we have to apply a new test to this case. And I want to start with the arresting officer. After they were chasing him between the houses, and he turned and said, I wish I'd have shot all you MFers like I could have. He dropped his gun, jumped over the fence, and they caught him. Put him on the ground. Now that officer's name was Jasernick or something like that. In the record at 1777, it says, I think, that he then gave the Miranda warnings right at that moment.
That's what he testified.
Okay. Now, how is that any different than any test we're talking about? He gave, at the first moment when they had him on the ground and caught him, they gave him his Miranda warnings.
We now have a situation with a lapse of time. We have a different officer doing it. We have an officer at Eastlake that, in fact...
Wait a minute, I just want to stop at that initial. See, that's what happens. You take me three steps down the road. I want to go at the very first step. Do you concede at the very first step he was properly given his Miranda warnings?
I don't concede that. I understand that's testimony.
Okay, you concede that there was testimony to that effect?
Absolutely.
Okay. Now, where do we go astray from there? Do we have to give them every time that he's going to ask another question, before he asks the next question? You remember your Miranda warnings here, I have to give them to you again? Do we have to do that every time, or does it not carry over from the fact that he was given his Miranda warnings immediately? I mean, you could just picture this in this dark and him with that gun and between those houses, and they even took the time to give him his Miranda warnings then, by the testimony.
My answer to you is the Dickerson case.
Okay.
And if the Dickerson case states, and I'm going to try and reiterate again, that Miranda has become embedded in routine police practices to the point where warrants have become part of our culture, then the answer would be yes, that it should have been given again, especially by a different
but
officer.
But didn't the Supreme Court mean when they said that's been become part of our culture, that they were not going to abandon the Miranda test? When I read Dickerson, that's what I gathered from it. The whole issue was, what, should we retain Miranda or should we abandon it? And they're saying it's become part of our culture, and therefore we're not going to abandon it.
I think it went farther than that.
How, what do you mean?
I think that it made the Miranda warnings a constitutional right.
They were always there.
I don't think the court went back and reiterated this my interpretation of this. They came back further and made it an absolute right that was not before. Because if it was not that, in fact, in the Randy case, they invited, this was part of the problem, they invited some sort of legislative erosion. And then Congress came back with 3501, and now, from my perspective, I see U.S. Supreme Court saying we should have been, should never have invited this on this particular issue. In fact, it is an absolute right that cannot be legislatively washed down the river. And they elevated it, and they made it strong. That's my interpretation. And that's where I think that all the standards and tests by the Court of Appeals in this regard are questioned in this case. And that's one of my requests, that this matter go back to the Court of Appeals for a proper review of the tests and standards as enunciated, not by Tom Lobey, but rather by the U.S. Supreme Court in a surprising 70-72 majority.
So,
I think we pretty well understand your argument. Sure. Let's go ahead to the victim impact.
Can you hear her?
No. I don't know if she answered.
It's propositional law 17, the victim impact. Very simply, those improper use of the victim impact statements in the mitigation phase by the state over the objection of defense counsel. You know, there are some other issues where they did object. In this particular case, there were specific objections. What you have in the controlling portion here is that you have a statute that specifically limits those issues that are to be used, which is 2929.04A, and it does not include the type of testimony that was used at the trial level. Additionally, you have the State versus Johnson, which sort of analyzes and limits the testimony that can be used in the mitigation phase. More importantly in this case, we have an objection by counsel, and we also have a motion, I think it was titled a motion to preclude testimony as opposed to standard motion in limine, which was in fact granted by the court. So in this regard, I don't know what more defense counsel could have in its arsenal other than a specific statute, case law, analysis strong on point, a filed written motion, and a court order. And notwithstanding the same, we have statements which were noted by Ms. Lukensen, all in contradiction of the statute, case law, and a court order that goes right to the heart. And I cite in my brief, that said, you know, I think an eye for an eye, I think this person should be looked up, or is that, I don't want to paraphrase, but I did put in my brief. So I had great difficulties with those particular points, which would then, of course, lead me to the end conclusion that that this court could, like the dissenting opinion by O'Neill in the Court of Appeals, affirm the conviction without the death penalty specifications, or remand it in its entirety.
If we were to look at that particular issue, would we not be required to give the normal latitude that we give to a bench trial, to say that though that testimony was heard by the trial judge, we can trust that the person sitting on the bench knows how to sort the proper testimony from the improper and disregard that should not have been given.
I think not, Your Honor. Again, this is a death penalty case. It is different than all other cases. It has a second phase. It has special rules of procedure, all the way from the trial level, through the mitigation, through the Court of Appeals, and even through here. We have always treated this as a sacred issue. And now to say that, well, it's harmless error,
we certainly, I mean, you concede that harmless error is a valid proposition even in capital cases. We find harmless error when it's not structural all the time.
I can agree only to a point, except for the fact that it's a capital case and it's a man's life. But I know that the court does it in certain circumstances,
right.
And I do appreciate it.
And this circumstance, I'm having trouble why this circumstance wouldn't be the sort that surely wouldn't rise to the... What would you say for us to think about that this trial judge could not or didn't, you know, why would that testimony be so prejudicial that a learned trial judge can't say, geez, I make that choice, not you, victim.
One of the realities is that one of the main benchmarks and cornerstones of our trial practice is live witness testimony. And it's different than knowing it's going to happen and when it happens. It's two different things. And you can't ignore them. When that person looks the judge in the eye and says, this was my family member and I want death and an eye for an eye, it makes an impact. And regardless of your ability to be, and Judge Jackson is and continues to be a very good seasoned trial lawyer. Absolutely, not a question about it. But that is the benchmark, and that's why we have, you know, cross-examination and all those other constitutional rights. When you put a person on the witness stand, it changes from what you think he's going to say and how he says it. It has impact. It has impacted on juries in deciding cases for guilt or not guilt or for millions of dollars or otherwise. So I don't think you can take it back at that point, especially when the judge didn't want to hear it.
Mm-hmm. So you would argue that the emotional impact has to be what distinguishes this from other harmless error?
I've tried, in getting outside of this case, I've tried death penalty cases. You can cut the tension with a knife in those rooms. And once you're at that position, once you're past the guilt and you're in the mitigation, the tension just seems to get mounts. You are now to, you know, life and death issues only. And the tension is beyond anything that I've encompassed in my 20 years of practice. And I do a lot of trial. With the remaining time, there's no more questions on that point. I would like to focus back on one little point very quick. That's proposition of law number 4 and 5, which dovetails into 15. The failure to provide grand jury transcripts, the failure to provide daily transcripts. It doesn't seem like on space that these are two issues that you could easily say harmless error. And if you divide them, you could say harmless error. When you look at the cumulative effect, that as a trial counsel, in a death penalty case, your most effective means in a case like this is cross-examination and the right to effective counsel. And the best way to cross-examine someone is with their sworn testimony. This court set forth the standard in State versus Greer of this particularized need. If a death penalty case does not show a particularized need, I can think of no greater case that would show a particularized need.
Well, does particularized need mean the importance of the case, or does it, in Greer, go to the particular fact scenario at issue and whether there's a particularized need to get those transcripts? And your argument is, gee, it's a death penalty case. that is a particularized need. Well, particularized doesn't say type of case, particularized case. It's particularized need at trial.
I agree with you. I'm highlighting the particularized case, of course.
Yeah.
But let's filter it down for a minute.
Right.
The particularized need of the particularized case.
There you go.
Now
you need to.
What are those issues? In the Court of Appeals, they came up with harmless error because, and I please, if I get the facts wrong, I apologize because I was not trial counsel. But one of the unindicted co-defendants testified, I believe, at the grand jury. He was not used by the state of Ohio in its case. That the Court of Appeals used that as a benchmark saying, well, he didn't testify, which gets me back to effective trial counsel, which I said I'm going to dovetail into Proposition 15. You know, the first thing as a trial guy, as a trial lawyer, when the state of Ohio doesn't use somebody, I get red flags. I don't want him. They're not using it for some reason. And I don't have ability and access to them in the same regard. My ears went back when I saw these particular issues. And I disagree vehemently with the Court of Appeals analysis that it is harmless error. Let's get down to the second proposition, daily transcripts. We have two attorneys by rule of court on a particularized case, and they ask for daily transcripts. All they want to do is be effective. And no matter if you have two attorneys or not, it is difficult because the state of Ohio usually has at least two prosecutors and maybe more at the table. And they are limited because they are assigned counsel. And yes, they are paid more than normal assigned counsel, but they don't have the, you know, law clerks and the ability to do that thing. And they would, all they want to do is be effective. And they ask for the daily transcripts, and they deny. Now, if you take the failure to provide the grand jury transcripts, which I have to assume on this particularized case, this particularized meeting, that Detective Doyle, who was the same individual in the motion to suppress, testified. Now, do I have proof of that? No. Is that the standard? Yes. Why? Because you're allowed to have hearsay evidence. And secondarily of the grand jury, in this particular case, to show more particularized need, they went direct and secret indictment. There was no preliminary. That also heightens my request for a particularized need for a particularized case. I assume I would have testimony of Doyle and maybe one of the unindicted co-defendants that did not testify. Couple that with the failure to provide daily transcripts, you have potential ineffective assistance counsel. You have to give those experienced trial lawyers the tools to do their job. And in this case, cross-examination, which is guaranteed by the U.S. and the Ohio constitutions, is paramount. And if you don't give the right carpenter the right tools, you're not going to have the right defense that's going to be there. And they asked for it and they were denied. Last issue is, time permitting, is the destruction of various evidence, Proposition 3. Getting back to the tape statement subject to the Brandeising analysis of Dickerson et al. In this particular case, one of the issues, even in this long 1 hour and 45 minute tape confession, was whether or not it was intentionally done or whether a struggle ensued. The issue raised, even in that particular statement, whether it should be suppressed or not, was whether or not there was a struggle. There was a destruction of panels, ramps, holsters, and in this particular case, they say, well, we took photographs and did things of this nature. But the ability to do a proper scene analysis, reconstruction, is in fact hampered when there is certain evidence that is destroyed. And this is not something that came up late in the game, as they would say. It happened at 2:22 in the morning during that custodial interrogation. It was known that part of the defense, now that he was making statements, was that it was not premeditated, that there was a struggle, And there comes to other sub-issues. The number of shots fired, how many, what location, et cetera, et cetera. And those were critical. And yes, we could say, well, we took a photograph of it. But not when an experienced police officer knows. From point one in his investigation, he is talking to the main suspect during the custodial interrogation, that those matters are deprived from defense. I think those aspects are critical. Again, the timing issue and the timelines are very important in this regard. Had they come up later, I would not be able to stand here with a straight face and make those type of arguments. But when they're made at this point, I think it becomes critical, especially when the matter could have come down to a murder, maybe a manslaughter, things of that nature. Any questions? Reserving time, if there's questions.
Thank you, Mr. Roby. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. Next case is DD 8733, just my counsel, versus Terrence Conrad Jones.
Very good.
Earlier periods. But from the standpoint of this presentation to the panel, to the board, and to this court, he has satisfied every requirement requested by disciplinary counsel and every requirement required by the rules. In addition to the matters that I mentioned, we also supplied a letter from his employer, which gave him the highest marks as to reliability, timeliness, punctuality, responsibility at the job that he had at the Economic Opportunity Planning Commission in Toledo, where he worked in public relations. We supplied records from Fresh Analysis indicating that he had not only gone to AA meetings and other related meetings, but he went to more than they even requested, and that he was periodically tested, and every test was negative.
Mr. Britz, what was the last evidence other than the respondent's statements at the panel? What was the most recent, I'll call it objective evidence for lack of a better term, that he had indeed, that he was recovering, that he really had was no longer addicted?
Well, I thought the letter from Fresh Attitudes indicated that.
But that was
a few months before the hearing, that's correct. That was supplied in a timely fashion at the request of disciplinary counsel. Now, there's been much made of the fact that Mr. Jones did not go to meetings during the 2 or 3 months immediately prior to the panel decision. I should point out, first of all, that this was a voluntary disclosure made by Mr. Jones, not pulled out of cross-examination. It was produced on direct examination by me at the hearing. In fact, I told Mr. Williams about it in the hall before we started the hearing. Now, I think it's significant that he came forward and made that disclosure. No one would have known otherwise. He could have easily gone in and just sidetracked that issue. But he insisted that he make a full and complete disclosure of everything, whether it was good or bad, and he did that. Now, he was examined rather closely by Mr. Henretta, member of the board. Mr. Henretta, I'm told, is somewhat of an expert on the subject of alcoholism or addiction. By the way, Mr. Jones has never had any problem with alcohol. He doesn't drink at all. Problem was entirely drugs and the drug that he used when he was using was cocaine. Now, he indicated at cross-examination that he began feeling uncomfortable at some of these meetings and relied on his church, which he says is an accepted avenue for recovery. And he's been a very loyal and regular attendance at church. Now, the panel seemed to harp on the fact that he didn't bring his sponsor to the hearing. That's true. Perhaps that was my fault. It never occurred to us that we should bring his sponsor. This brings into light the rather strange procedural problem that we found. We filed this petition in February, and the panel was assigned not too long after that, and then we heard nothing. I contacted the chairman, Mr. Henretta, and asked when this hearing might be held, and he didn't know at that time. It wasn't until the 12th of November of 1999, at 4:45 in the afternoon, on Friday, that I received notice that this hearing was going to be held a week from that Monday. And didn't even have an opportunity to consult with Mr. Jones until the following Monday. We understand that we have the right to subpoena witnesses, but I question the effectiveness of subpoenaing witnesses to Cleveland, obtaining those subpoenas from the clerk, getting them to these various judges, and getting them on such short notice to appear. As I've indicated, both to this court and to the panel, I've handled many disciplinary matters at different levels. And everyone that's gone to a panel hearing, the panel has sat in the home city of the lawyer, in this case, Toledo. In this case, the hearing was held in Cleveland. Two, I think, of the members of the panel were from Akron or Cleveland. One was from Akron. They were all from that area. We came over to their venue. And that made it increasingly difficult for us to get the kind of people that we wanted at such short notice. Now, the panel makes a finding without citing any facts that Mr. Jones did not appear to be humble and contrite, or words to that effect. Mr. Jones was trying to be honest, and sometimes honesty does not appear to be humility. He was telling it like it is, and that's what he's always did as a lawyer. He told it like it was. So I don't think there was any basis for the panel, other than their own subjective conclusions, that he did not show the proper humility. He was cross-examined at quite some length by Mr. Robin Weaver, a member of the panel. And that's where the fireworks, if you want to call it that, took place. Weaver was dwelling on materials that were supplied after stipulation was entered into at the time of the 1988 disciplinary proceedings. A series of uncomplimentary letters from certain lawyers, judges, and police officers. He had never had an opportunity to rebut any of that information. There was never any hearing on that information, and we don't believe that information had any probative value. And yet Mr. Weaver incessantly cross-examined him about these allegations. There was one allegation, in fact, where he said that a judge of the Court of Appeals had made a disparaging remark about him. Mr. Jones corrected it and said that that was not a judge of the Court of Appeals, it was a judge of the Court of Common Pleas. And the Court of Appeals ultimately reversed that decision. That's the case in which Mr. Jones was a witness, having been an attorney in a previous case. And Mr. Weaver snapped at me, well, I want to see that decision, as though we were making it up. But within a matter of days, I had that decision obtained from the archives of the Court of Appeals. It was forwarded to all the panel members and to disciplinary counsel. And it did indeed indicate that Mr. Jones, that the decision of the Court of Common Pleas in that case was reversed. The only difference was Jones thought it was reversed unanimously. It turned out that it was reversed 2-1. Now, despite all of the adverse material that appeared in the file and the various convictions that were the basis of the original suspension, we pointed out then, as I point out now, that he was not disbarred. He was suspended. And he was suspended indefinitely with the hope in his mind of being reinstated. And he waited a long time until he really felt that he was clean and able to return to the bar of Ohio and be a responsible advocate. He waited many years, and it wasn't until 1999 that we filed this petition. We point out that although the panel commented that the attorney called only himself as a witness, the disciplinary counsel called no witnesses and took no position in the matter. In fact, as far as we can tell, did no investigation of this matter representation of Mr. Jones by disciplinary counsel was limited primarily to the issue of his not attending the AA meetings. I also want to comment on the one conviction that he had. It was asked in the letter whether he had any convictions. He said, yes, he did have one. That was a case where he tried the case himself in Los Angeles. There was a hung jury. And then, since he had recently had open heart surgery, he felt he was really not up to a second trial. He entered into a plea bargain where he got no time, no fine, no probation. It was an offer he could not afford to refuse. In conclusion, if the court retains concerns about Mr. Jones, we suggest that perhaps a probationary period would be appropriate. He could certainly be monitored, and the courts and the prosecutors and the other lawyers would be more than happy to report on his progress. We think he made a strong showing that for at least 3 years, more than the required two, that for at least 3 years, he had the moral, mental, and educational qualities required for reinstatement. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ritz. Ritz, I'm sorry. Mr. Coleman.
May it please the court, I'm John Coleman. For later in this matter, I would just like to advise the court that Mr. Williams, whose case this was, his wife is having a baby. As of last night, I have heard his delivery occurred this morning. As to this matter, I would just indicate a number of factors I think the court should consider. First, the testimony at the hearing was somewhat confusing. There were affidavits that were submitted to the court with respondent petitioner's objections. Those affidavits attempt to clarify the evidence as to his conduct and his attendance at meetings while he was in California. And I think that part of the problem for the panel and the board was that the testimony at the hearing was confusing. Primarily what I'm focusing on is in the affidavits, he brought forth that he goes to California in 1989 after being suspended in 88, and he's there until December of 90, some year or more, while he's engaging in the use of narcotics. Drug of choice by his testimony is cocaine. December of 90, according to his affidavits, he goes to a treatment program until August of 91. Again, if we accept his affidavits, he stays sober and or clean until sometime in 97, a period of between 6 and 7 years. It is sometime in 97, faced with the prospect of coming back to Ohio, that he has a one-day relapse. And he has that arrest, which is ultimately a misdemeanor, possession of drug paraphernalia. He comes back to Ohio in 97, and he has, from all evidence that we've been able to ascertain, remained clean and done well since his return to the Toledo area in 97. The panel, I think, was faced with his confusing testimony about his time in California. In the hearing, he testified that during that time, he relapsed 20 to 25 occasions, anywhere from 1 to 4 days. He never clarified, as he has done in his affidavits, that he was referring to the time before he entered the treatment program in December of 90. He also, at one point, was asked, well, during 87 to 97, what was your drug of choice? And he said, cocaine. Again, I believe that may have led the panel to believe he was actively using during that period. His affidavits are to the contrary. I'm not standing here telling you that we have direct information as to which is accurate, but I believe that that may be why the panel was concerned about his behavior during that time period. As the court is well aware, the board and the panel focused on his sporadic attendance while in California. Unfortunately, at the hearing, he never completely testified to his attendance at meetings while in California.
I'm the one to say
there's testimony he did attend, but he didn't indicate the extent of that attendance. He did testify to different kinds of programs that he would be
The board also was concerned. Let me stop you. He returned to Ohio in 97. That's right. And you indicated that there's no evidence that he was not clean between that time and the panel hearing in 99.
What we have in the record is a fresh attitude letter that he was was going 7 days a week from March of 98 through June of 99. And we know by his testimony, he continued that until September of 99.
The board seems, or the panel seems to say that, in effect, that's not enough because his treatment, the recovery, has been so sporadic that essentially he hasn't, we don't have good evidence that he's been clean long enough. I think that's one of the things
the board is looking at. You're talking about a 15-year period. He initially had a problem that we first know of in 85. That's when he's convicted of felony drug abuse. And there's letters in that file indicating that a drug problem that he acknowledged was dealing with. Between then and today, we really have 97 to today, a 3-year period where he is actually clean that we can verify completely. He does, in his affidavits, indicate he was clean for a period of time in the 90s.
What's your response to Mr. Fritz's suggestion that we reinstate him and for a probationary period? And I guess I'm curious whether Mr. Fritz says there'd be a lot of lawyers in Toledo would be happy to monitor. I didn't realize that was the situation. I hope that's true, but that's good news if it's true. What's your response to that suggestion?
Well, I didn't attend the hearing, but from reading the transcript, from viewing the file, I believe that it's a reasonable proposition to place this man on strict probation. He apparently is doing well in Toledo right now. He's not having any problems there. And I think that if he continues with a strict program of dealing with his drug addiction, that it's a worthwhile risk. But I don't think it's appropriate to just place him back into the bar without any supervision. I think that would be a mistake. If there's any other questions, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Coburn. Mr. Rich, you saved a minute of your time for rebuttal.
I'd just like to point out that Mr. Jones was a very talented, successful practitioner. The letters that we attached to our notebook for the panel, including one from our U.S. District Judge, who was one of the champions, indicates that we need him, that the black community needs a lawyer of that caliber in Lucas County. And they're looking to this court to bring him back. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.